There was something that was brought up here, and that was the difference between harm and hurt feelings. And here's an example of that. I had a business partner, and I was the senior partner, and he found out when he got in the business that he was afraid to do what he had to do, which was to go out and find new business and basically do a lot of selling. And so I wound up doing about 90% of the business. And he felt really bad about it and spent most of his time apologizing to me for not being able to do what he needed to do to make the business successful. And then he would go out and have lunch with his friends and talk about how much money he was making. And that went on for some time, and he wouldn't let it go, so I fired him. And then his brother talked him into suing me for $4.5 million. Yeah, I didn't think that was very nice. And for the longest time, I felt like I owed him an amend for firing him. Because when I did fire him, he really felt bad. And I thought, well, I caused that, and so I must have some culpability in the middle of this. And I kept trying to find some way to make that right. And I kept going. I probably went to 3 or 4 different people and said, tell me what the harm is in that. I know there's some harm. I just don't know how to get to it. And they said, you didn't harm him. You just took him away from something he didn't want to do. And the fact that you fired him just meant that as a pure business decision, he had no business working there. And I said, well, apparently he thinks differently because the son of a bitch sued me for $4.5 million. And then I'll tell you one other thing about that. And that is a line in the book that says, we avoid retaliation and argument. And so I had a good friend. In fact, it was Lisa's husband. And I would not defend myself against this lawsuit because it says we avoid retaliation and argument. And so I just was kind of letting it go along, and I was really worried about it. And Lisa's husband came up and said the best defense is a good offense. And he was running a large law firm in Denver at the time. And he said, I have a litigator over here that can stop this in its tracks in the first 15 minutes. And I said, great. And a week later, I wasn't being sued anymore. So you have to be clear about the harm anyway. That's the point of this. In that, don't be spending your time running around thinking you were Genghis Khan, or you know that you harmed everyone that you'd ever met in your life or whatever. Be real clear about what the harm is and then go try and balance it. And most of the time what you want to do is have some idea about how you can balance that before you ever get there. Now, one other thing that I should mention, and that is that if you have the courage, what you may want to do on the end of your amend is to say, have I harmed you in any manner that I'm unaware of? Then hang on to your hat. When I did that with my first wife, it isn't like I've been married a lot of times, but I've been married twice. And with my first wife, I said, is there any way that I've harmed you that I'm unaware of? And she said, now that you mention it. And went on for about the next hour and a half. And she wasn't done. And I had to go to, had some sort of appointment that I had to get to. And I said, I'll give you a call and we'll find a time and you can tell me whatever it is that you haven't had the opportunity to yet. And I called Don and I said, let me tell you what's going on with this. And he said, okay. And I said, I think it's a little abusive. Well, only because I think she was really angry at me. And it was about, let me show you what I'm going to do to you. And at some point it sort of lost something in the translation because it was just pure anger after a period of time. So he said, call her up and tell her, give her an appointment and tell her you'll sit down with her for an hour. And that she ought to consider anything that she hasn't told you so far and figure out some way to pack that into the next hour, and then you go listen to it. So that's what I did. And at the end of that, everything was done. Okay? So sometimes you can run into some people who are really angry at whatever you did to them, and just be reasonable about what you're willing to listen to. And if it goes past the business of amends and gets to abuse, stop. Making amends is not taking a beating. All right? It's balancing the books. So that woman, I said, is there anything else I can do to make this right? And she said, yeah, marry me again. Lord, protect us. You just... most of my amends these days are... they're important, but it's about little... almost embarrassingly pedestrian things. I had to make amends to my kids after I was divorced the last time. And I thought, now here's how your ego works, okay? My ex-wife, or was then my wife, we were going to get a divorce, and she said, you need to move out. And the only reason why I hadn't moved out before that was because I didn't want to damage my kids any more than they already were damaged. They weren't damaged that badly, but I mean it. And so, she said, you need to move, and I seemed to be slow in moving, so she went and got a boyfriend, and that cut it. God damn. And so I moved out, and as soon as I moved out, here's what my ego told me. I had started a new business and it wasn't making a lot of money, and all of a sudden I thought I was going to be living under a bridge. And so I went and rented a two-bedroom townhouse. And I got three kids. And I thought, these kids are going to hate me. My business is going to fail. I'm going to be living under a bridge. I'm going to be broke for the rest of my life. You hear my ego? It's all lies. Okay? So I rented this townhouse, and I got up and went to work every day. And the business wound up being the largest of its type in the state. And I went from being almost flat broke to being financially secure. Okay? And it was... And anyway, I had to make amends to my sons. And the amend that I had to make to them was that I was so obsessed with my dislike of their mother that I wasn't giving them the attention that they deserved. That's my fault. And so my amend to them was, I'm going to be absolutely the best father that I can be to you, and I'm going to do everything I can to enhance your life every day of my life. And my two youngest, I have twin boys, I have five sons, but the two youngest are seniors in high school this year. One's 6'3 and 230, the other one's 6'4 and 240. And the 6'3 one has been the starting nose tackle on the Arapahoe High School football team for the last 3 years, ever since he was a sophomore. Because he's a sweet kid, but he gets on a football field and everybody better duck. And he played the nose tackle on defense. And this year, when they were honoring all the seniors, you go out on the football field with them, and they introduce the player, and he has his parents on both sides, and my ex-wife and I were standing on both sides of him. And they said, "This is Alex Olson, and he's an honor student. He's been the starting nose tackle for the last 3 years. He is going to Colorado State University, and the most influential person in his life is his dad." I didn't know they were going to say that. Jesus, I mean, you could have pushed me over with a feather right in the middle of that football field. But I found something out, and that is that they didn't have to grow up hearing what I grew up with. And what I grew up with is, you're stupid, you're clumsy, you're going to wind up in a prison or an institution, you'll never amount to anything, you'll never be a success at anything. That's what I grew up with. And see, I don't talk to my kids that way, because every time you say something to a kid, it's like planting a seed. And because you are an authority figure, they're going to take that seed and they're going to fertilize it and they're going to water it and they're going to protect it, even though it's the worst goddamn lie that they ever heard. So when you talk to children, what you tell them is, you're handsome, you're smart, you have the whole world in front of you. Don't let anyone tell you that you're less than you are. You are a bright and successful young person who has the whole world in front of you. And they believe it. My 21-year-old son is graduating in May from Southern Methodist University with a straight-A average in engineering. He took the LSATs, which is the precursor for law, and scored a 99.9. Wow. He's now being pursued by Harvard Law School with a full scholarship and a stipend to live on while he's there, plus about 20 other major universities. And all that kid ever heard when he was growing up was, you're smart, you're handsome, you're successful, you can be anything you want to be, And all you got to do is go out there and risk, take the chances, don't be afraid of anything, you can do it. Okay? Thank God I don't have to make amends to my kids for telling them that they couldn't do stuff. Tell kids, if you're going to talk to them, that they can do anything, and they're going to believe you because you're their parent. It makes a huge difference. So, the other thing is, and it's, you know, it was true in my case, and I think that it was true in Gary's case, and that is, if you own a man, make it. Right? Don't wait. The time you make amends is now. And then maybe you don't have to be sitting by some headstone trying to talk to someone that's already passed. So, thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? Shelley? How do you go about making amends to someone who's dead? I know of two instances, and they seem to have been both helpful. You remember Bill Boom? A number of years ago, a friend of ours in Denver had a friend who had been instrumental in the death of his baby and was asking how to make the amend and how to go about it. And a lot of prayer, many of us were asked, none of us knew. And somebody told him to go and write that child a letter and tell him everything he ever wanted to tell him. And put a lot of prayer and thought into it to do that. And he did. And he wrote the letter, and then he went back to the sponsor, and he said, now what I do? He said, I want you to put an infant in an envelope and address it to yourself and drop it in the mailbox. And he did that. And when he got the letter back, he was told some of the words had been changed in the letter. Believe it or not, it sure worked for them. One of my better friends in Indianapolis, a fellow named Earl, and Earl, in his drinking, had been thrown out of the house. And he had not been a nice husband. I don't think he had ever been violent, but he could beat you to death with words. And they're living separated. And when one day he got a call from his wife, of course she had the kids, she said, come over to the house, I need to talk to you. And so when he went up on the steps and he rang the doorbell, he heard a boom and she'd blown her brains out. There was hell to pay for that. And he was never arrested, but he was certainly thought bad of about that maybe he'd killed her. First time I'd ever had a sponsee that was dealing with stuff like that after he came in. And I must have listened to a half a dozen inventories about him, and he'd written about her, and his resentment was because she'd had an affair with his best friend. He went over that and over that, and we would discuss it. And finally one day, after a meeting, I cornered him, and I fired him, and I said, I can't help you. You won't listen to me. I said, you owe that girl an amend, and you need to get it made. I'm done. I can't help you. And I left, and about 3 days later, I got a call from him. And he said, "Can I come over and see you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he came over and he sat down and he said, "I went to the graveyard and I found her grave and I sat down at the stone and I must have talked to her for 4 or 5 hours." He says, "I didn't stop crying for 2 days." And he made them in. And those have been fine since. I don't know what else you could do than either one of those instances with that. The guy that told me the story about the baby is a guy I believe, a very believable guy. He was not necessarily one of our gang, but he was as solid a person as you could ever meet with that. And I know what Earl told me. Sure, Earl and I talk on the phone. He lives down in Mexico now, but we talk every day. Part of my reviewing, everyone, I go through the steps as a whole, is I review my amends, and I review the people out there with that I might have owed one. And I look at my parents, and they've both been long gone. But I reconsider all of that stuff. And I'd like to be to the point with my amends and that sort of thing that if somehow I should know that I'm going to be gone in the next 30 minutes, I'm absolutely ready. Don't owe anybody nothing. Don't want to leave anybody out there if I can be of help to them. It's not that I want to go, that isn't it. But I'd like to know, okay, if God's ready, I'm ready. And that's what it is. And that's one reason to keep looking and keep trying to find out.
Let me give you an example of that. 5 years ago, I went out, I walk a lot, so I went out in the morning and walked 5 miles, and then I thought, well, I'm going to go play golf. So I went and played 9 holes of golf and carried a bag, and then I had a doctor's appointment, so I went to the doctor. He said, how's everything going? And I said, I have indigestion, which seems to happen more often now. And he said, you need a treadmill. And I said, why? And he said, because many times angina masquerades as indigestion. And I said, I don't have any heart disease in my family. And I did all this stuff this morning, and I'm still standing here. And he said, I don't care, I want you to take a treadmill anyway. So I did. And I took this thing called a thallium treadmill where they shoot you up with a radioactive isotope. Oh, swell. And you think you're going to start glowing in the dark. And I went over and I took this treadmill, and the guy that was watching it said, there's something wrong here. And I said, well, I don't feel like it's wrong. And so he had this doctor look at it. And the doctor said, we need to do an angiogram on you, where they stick this thing in your groin, and then they look at your heart, go up it through some sort of vein or whatever. And they did that, right away. And there was this little Oriental lady that was a cardiologist that was doing it. And then I was watching it and fell asleep because I thought it was boring as hell. So when I woke up, there was a different cardiologist standing next to me. And he said, can I be candid with you? That's not a good way to start a conversation with a cardiologist. And I said, sure. And he said, you have one artery that's completely blocked, one that's 95% blocked, and one that's 85% blocked, and you're having a triple bypass at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. Oh. And he said, is that a scary proposition for you? And I told him no, and I was perfectly candid. I said, no, it's not. And he said, well, I don't hear that very often. And he said, why not? And I said, because I don't have a lot of unfinished business here. Which is exactly what Gary just said. You know, I go today. I'd like to watch my kids go to college, at the very least. I mean, I'd like to see them get married and have children and do all that stuff. I probably won't be around for all of that. But I don't have any unfinished business here. I've made my amends. I'm living a life that I think is productive. And I think that all things considered, that it's been a positive experience for both me and the world. Now, that's an awful thing to say, but I work very hard at doing that. So, you know, when I was 58, I think, I'd come down with diabetes, and I was floating in and out of a coma. And that's what I thought about. Has my life made an ounce of difference? See, and at some point you may have to ask yourself the same question. And I'll tell you, that's a hell of a motivator to start doing something positive with your life and start trying to make someone else's life better. And we're going to talk about this in a moment, but you know, in the 11th step, there's a plan for the day. Two of the things that are on my plan for the day every day. Number one is be happy, because I have to work at that. Isn't that awful? I thought you ought to just do that naturally. And I have to get up and work at being happy. And so I do. And the other thing that's always on that list is try to make someone else's life better every day. Because that's our real purpose here. So,
I think you and I talk on the phone while you're on the gurney waiting to go in for that bypass.
We may very well have.
Yeah. I remember I was kind of surprised when you told me that's where you were at.
Right.
Step 10, I guess. Many years ago, back in Denver, Don and Mickey and I were having a conversation about the 10th step. And we decided we were going to do it precisely like it says. We're just right down to the gnat's eyebrow. We were going to get this thing and just do it perfectly. We were at that point in time, one of the few times where all three of us were available to be on the telephones during the day or any other time. And so we thought we would just do that. And I can give you a couple examples how that would work. I had a partner back then in the business she drive me nuts. Just crazy. And she had been away from the business for a year recovering from breast cancer. And when she came back, some things hadn't been run in the office well. I had used the company credit card to buy some personal things for myself. And that seemed to irritate her, and I hadn't been hard enough on some of the employees on her side of the business. They should have sold more and done more work, and just about on and on and on. And it never quit. I made all those things right and did my best with it, and it just never quit. And so I just had my days. And I remember the day I called Don, I said, I'm going to kill TJ. And Don says, really? He says, yeah. He says, so where have you been selfish in this? Well, when you're that angry, that's what you don't want to talk about. That's where I've been. I guarantee that's not what you want to think about. And so you got to stop all this ranting and raving long enough to figure out what it is. And in the middle of that anger, that's very difficult to do. And so I finally come up with an answer that seemed to satisfy me again. And he says, well, where have you been dishonest? Oh, I bet you. And you go through it again. And resentful. And where was I afraid? And so the time we get down and we get through that, I'm pretty well done with that, and I've discussed it. And the only thing I don't remember him asking me if I'd asked God to remove it, because the answer would have been, hell no, I haven't asked God to remove it. And, we went it that day, and he said, you owe an amend. And I said, yeah. And he says, what is it? And so I spelled it out. And then he had some intuition that I don't know many people that had it. He said, wait for me, I'll come down there and when you go make it. And so he came out there to the office there and sat outside TJ's door while I went in to make the amend and all that. And that was, I mean, you paid a price to go make an amend with TJ. And I did, and I apparently did it properly. And so that night we went up to Denver General Hospital and we hustled drunks there on the detox ward. If you don't get the opportunity to do that these days because they won't let you on the wards, but going on guys on the detox wards or ain't looking for a 12-step call is really a kick. And it can be a great time. But he and Mickey and I started to do that, and we started this thing that Bob calls having 10-step buddies. And that worked real well for us for a while, and it really did. And then when I moved to Indianapolis and all that fell apart, and Mickey's situation had changed, and that Don was about my only 10-step buddy for a long time. But we did it long distance for a long time, and he went on to be trustee. And I would get calls from some of the damnedest places to listen to his 10-step. But they're just so important. And just take it literally. It's just not complicated. The key words. Let me see. I'll see if I can see really there. This thought brings us to step 10. What am I doing that? I can't see that. Which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to write any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. It's not an overnight matter. It should continue for our life. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when these crop up, we ask God for the key words, or the next two words. At once. Okay? Okay. To remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we can resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And I see those as the key words. And I try to do that. But I still write my 10th steps. I have never learned to write inventory. We were taught to write inventory. And I read this 10th step, but I didn't see anything about that. I don't have to write it anymore just because it's the 10th step. So I still write my inventory. So I take a few minutes out anymore to do that. And, you've done that for a while. It's easy. You don't have to worry about the drama. You can get right down to the good stuff here. Get down to the meat of it and do it. And but that's my 10th step thing very much most of the time. Most of my 10th step buddies are guys in Indianapolis that I hang around. Tom's met some of them. I don't know if you ever met Jim, but and Earl and these guys that we just do that with. And some of you know mine, but that's really important. And I've gone down the list to make sure I could catch one right away. It's not, well, I'm not going to wait for Mike to get back in town, you know. I have a friend there. I'm going to be out of step here just a little bit. I have a friend, a man I sponsor for about the whole time I've been in Indianapolis. His name is Jim, and Jim is one of those sponsees that came in that He was a fighter. And you told him that the book said to do something, his answer was bullshit, 8 out of 10. And I like those guys better than the guys that do that just sit and nod, okay. Because you'll never get them to do a damn thing. But the fighters, you're more likely to get them going. And we fought around the third stage. He's at the third step, and we've been talking about God, and he's denying the God, angrily. He's got a resentment at God, but we can't do it yet. He's got to do that. And he's driving, there's Interstate 465, the 60-mile highway that circles Indianapolis. And he's screaming around that highway at 90, 100 miles an hour, and he finally stops and goes home. He says, don't give me this stuff about this again. He says, I'm getting tired of it. I've been driving around the interstate like that, hollering at God. Call him in a no good so and so and all that. And so I let him rant for a minute. Don't tell me there's any God. He said, I know, but I just went around and did that. And I said, well, who were you hollering at? He said, God. I said, there must be a God. He gave me a two word answer and slammed the phone down. And then he finally gets it and he moves on, and I don't know how many of his inventories I've listened to over the years, but he's the one that caught on to four column inventory right away and can be just as insightful, and Tom knows him. He's sitting over there nodding about him. He's one of these guys that can really get down to the meat, and a tremendous sponsor and works with tons of people, very effective with the Vietnam vets who come back, who are dealing with all the things they're dealing with. And Jim's very effective because he can show them he dealt with some horrible stuff just through our 12 steps. Did that. Well, he's 20, whatever it is, 3 or 4 years sober now, and is dying from a disease and multiple systems atrophy. And that just means that there's these automatic systems in your body that's running or atrophying. They're just shutting down. And he's been, for the last 2 years, going through that. And he's horizontal most of the time now in a wheelchair or the bed. And he's on the phone 8-10 hours a day working with people still. And last Tuesday, I went, instead of going to my home group, I went and sat with Jim. We had our own damn meeting. We didn't need them. A great time, and I watch him go through this stuff, and he's spending most of his time looking at his 10th step and meditating. And he loves it when you come over and just want to sit and meditate with him. But we still are 10th step buddies, because he'll get some little resentment going anymore. It's pretty much a God, and maybe it's the people delivering the oxygen to him, or whatever it is, but he's quick to do the 10th step and to move on. I learned a part about sponsorship I didn't know here in these last couple of years. There's another guy named Dick Martin who's 28 years sober that I 12-step and sponsored all this time and all that, and he's had major surgery on his brain a couple of times. And I'm the one that's been given the power of attorney to make the calls when things aren't going well. And I didn't know that was going to be a part of sponsorship. But by God, isn't it? But I'm glad to do it. And I just think it's part of this deal that God's lined up for us to do that. And I'm only talking about that around the 10th step right now because I can't get Jim out of 10, 11, and 12. He's one of the most capable sponsors I've ever known, and 12-steppers and 10th-steppers and all of that. And it's just so much a part of his life. He doesn't get out of bed necessarily to do it, but he'll be just as clear as you can be with where he's being selfish, dishonest, resentful, or frightened. Go through that. And who can you help right now? And it'd be cost for mine, and he's got a sponsee we laugh about and all that. It's his biggest pain in the neck. He calls us his highest maintenance sponsee. So I guess I better call Elliot. And then, And he does. But I think I gave 10 and 11, 12 pretty poor attention for an awful big part of my life in AA. And it certainly does not replace the regular inventory. And can't remember who it was, but we were sitting in a meeting sometime in the past, Bob, and somebody said, well, I just maintain my life now on 10, 11, and 12. And some woman in the group said, oh, really? And I've never been able to do that. I still have more to do, no matter how quickly I try to seem to look at 10. And the selfishness and the dishonesty and the resentment and the fear. Go ahead.
The business about taking four steps regularly has to do with a line in the book that says a business that takes no regular inventory is sure to fail. And you can take your 10 steps and you can work 10, 11, and 12, but unless you're perfect at it, and I've never met anyone like that, eventually it's going to really be helpful to write inventory. On the end of the 10th step, how many of you were at that meeting last night? Okay. At the end of the 10th step, it talks about carrying the vision of God's will into all our activities. And that's a wonderful exercise. And if you have enough presence of mind to do it, when you get up in the morning, as part of your daily plan to make carrying the vision of God's will into all your activities, it really makes your day run easier. Because every time you change activities, if you say, God, please help me to take a vision of your will into this activity with me, that just seems to even out your day. And that helps you in the 11th step, because the 11th step is about staying in a spiritual sense through the day. Now, the 10th step spiritually is about being here now. When it says continue to watch, all right? Continue to watch with selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And a great deal about the 10th step is about being aware, about seeing what's going on around you. And, you know, there are some great proponents of that. Ram Dass, Eckhart Tolle, all those guys wrote books about be here now. Be in the present moment. This is the only place you have to live. Don't live in the future. Don't live in the past. Live in the present moment. And that's what the 10th step is about be here now and watch what's going on and be aware of what's happening around you. That's what that's about. It's been invaluable to me to have 10th step buddies that I've asked permission to call and that I can call anytime I'm in doing any of those things. I mentioned last night that probably 80% of what you're going to talk about in the 10th step is fear. Although it talks about selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, the thing that you're going to talk about most is fear. And telling someone that you're afraid. And then they're going to go through this exercise that Gary described. And one of the things that it does is it lends perspective to what's going on with you. So you may have this perspective where everything's gone to hell, and you may have no reason to believe that. And so people, if they're an unaffected third party, are going to tell you, why would you ever believe that? That isn't what it looks like to me. And so a part of that whole process, other than sharing it with someone, has to do with gaining perspective about what's going on. There's an enormous amount of value. I also mentioned last night that most new people don't like to 10-step. And the reason why most new people don't like to 10-step is that they're still protecting their ego. Which means I'm not going to let you see me because it's going to embarrass me and you're going to think that I'm not very good at this. You know, it's like being 36 years sober and expecting to be perfect. Ain't going to happen. Maybe at 45, but... you know, we need an outlet for that. And if you're too damn embarrassed to tell people what's going on for you, you're missing the point. Allow someone else to see you. There is a great spiritual benefit in allowing other people to see you. Drop your defenses and let somebody know what's going on. You know, one of the great benefits of this program is having some people around you that know who the hell you are. You know, we all have this basic belief that we're not good enough. Nobody ever defines it because they say good enough for what? We just say we're not good enough. That's an emotional trap. Okay? We all think we're not good enough, and if we don't put some sort of facade up in front of us, that people are not going to accept us because we have this basic belief that by ourselves, why should they? So we got to kind of put some window dressing out there. We got to put a bow on it. So we become acceptable. That's bullshit. You're just fine. You know, we're not who we can be, but we are who we are today. And we're a hell of a lot better than we were in the past. So why are we embarrassed about who we are? That all falls back on what we believe about ourselves. You're just fine. You know there's some work to be done, but that's part of this deal. So don't be embarrassed to be who you are. You are one of God's children. And God made you uniquely with these skills and abilities. And for you to say, I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you who I am, is like slapping God in the face. Why would you? You're just fine. But let somebody know who you are. And that's what the 10th step is about. So I can kind of stay clean, but the problem is that my ego rebuilds itself. It becomes resurgent. And over time, it overcomes my 10th step. It overwhelms my 10th step. And all of a sudden, I'm back into the bedevilments. And then I know it's time to take inventory. Okay? So, you know that thing in the back by Herbert Spencer about... thank you. About contempt prior to investigation? Don't have that about the 10th step. Don't get it in your head, well, why the hell should I do that? I'm just going to tell a bunch of embarrassing things to somebody that's going to think I'm stupid. That isn't what they're going to think. So don't have contempt prior to investigation about the 10th step. Just go out and do it and see if it makes a difference. And you'll see how valuable a part of that is. And then you're going to do what I do, which is 10th step almost every day. A guy asked me early on, actually it was this guy named Mike Vicenius that Gary had mentioned before, and he said, are you doing your 10th step? And I said, no. And he said, why are you settling for half a loaf? And I said, I don't know, because I don't want to do it. And he said, you don't know this, but you're really shortchanging yourself by not following the directions. And there's enormous benefit in doing this, even though you are uncomfortable doing it. So he said, you might want to consider following the directions. So I did, and it's made a big difference.
Gary?
Yeah, Tom, go ahead. We're getting high sign, take a break here, so, but go ahead, Tom.
Okay. I wondered if you could speak a little. I've heard you and Mike both talk about 10-stepping with newcomers, people who have a lot less sobriety than you have, and how helpful that can be to bring them into the group.
Yeah, Tom has heard stories from Mike and me about 10-stepping with newcomers, and I started doing that because nobody else was around. I was caught out in the middle of nowhere, and I had one of my matchbook inventories with me, and it was important stuff, and I didn't want it to fester. And I knew Mike and a couple other guys were having lunch, and so I muscled in on the lunch, and both guys were new, and both guys were in the inventory. And they'd always act a little squirmy when I'd be around because I was such an old timer and all that. And we had lunch, and I said, "Listen, I need you guys' attention." But I knew Mike would pick up on him because he's one of my buddies. But so I went through the 10th step just like we talked about it with that, and got to the end of it, and Mike asked me a couple of the questions. I'd done a pretty good job with it, but I still needed some coaching. And then when I got done with it, I didn't think anything about it, and I really didn't. And one of the new guys a few weeks later was given one of his first talks at a meeting, and he says, "I think I got to do this shit the rest of my life." He says, "I couldn't believe it. Gary came up and shared inventory with Steve and Mike and I. I just did it because they were alcoholics and they were there. I really didn't think about them being new guys." But that's something I've done a lot. And it's not just with those guys. It's just that they happen to be there with that. And it's always had good results. Now, if I think about it, I got way too much sobriety and serenity and spirituality to let them know I'm such a jerk that I'm going to go up and share that stuff with them and all that. And that's the lie that he's talking about that's going on in my ego's giving. We better take a break. We'll see you in about 20 minutes.